Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Ahmed Rashid, a journalist based in Lahore, Pakistan. He has covered Afghanistan, Central Asia, and Pakistan for more than 20 years, and he is the author of Taliban and, most recently, Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. Welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks a lot.
Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Rawalpindi in Pakistan, in northern Pakistan. And then, after the Second World War, my family were based partly some of the time in Pakistan and some of the time in London. So I grew up in both places. So, in the 50s, I had perhaps, if you like, quite a cosmopolitan kind of life and education. And then subsequently, I went to college in Pakistan and then went to university at Cambridge.
And how did your parents shape your character, you think, in retrospect?
Well, I dedicate the Taliban book to my mother because, I mean, she was an incredibly inquisitive a person who paid attention to absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was a very traditional, Indian Muslim woman, grew up in British India, but she had incredible curiosity about everything. And she, even while we were kids, she used to take us on these wild trips. I mean, even without very much money, we used to be sleeping in the cars, I remember, as kids, and traveling and camping in Europe. And we drove once from London to Karachi in the 60s with her, so she was this kind of very adventurous person. And my father was the kind of more stabilizing influence, if you like, in the family.
And was there a discussion of politics and current events and world affairs at the dinner table?
Yes, always. I mean, Pakistan, I don't think any society is more politicized than Pakistan because we've been through so many traumas and so much political upheaval and unrest that, even as children, there's no Pakistani child. I mean, when Pakistanis get together, the first thing they talk about is, the politics at home and what's going on. So this is an incredibly politicized society and people.
Mm-hmm. And where were you educated?
I went to college in England and in Pakistan, and then got my degree from Cambridge. And I was at Cambridge during 1968, mm-hmm. During the anti-Vietnam movements. Learned a lot about Berkeley, and knew about a lot that was going on here.
And how did the 60s affect you, do you think, in retrospect?
Well, certainly it radicalized me very much. I mean, I think the experiences there, I was in Paris in 68, but really, we were, Pakistanis in particular, were very radicalized by 68 to 70 because of the war in Bangladesh, mm-hmm. which was then East Pakistan. And this had a very traumatic effect on Pakistani leftists, on liberals, on because the military conducted this war in a particularly brutal fashion, killing tens of thousands of Bengalis, East Pakistanis. And then Bangladesh became independent and the army was defeated. And there was a major political upheaval in Pakistan. So that was a period of enormous kind of political ferment mm-hmm. in Pakistan where you had, the left was very strong at that time.
And I'm curious, why journalism with this background? Why did you choose that as a...
Actually, it was by accident. I mean, in many respects, I've always been interested in the... In ethnicity and the ethnic groups in Pakistan. I mean, I never did a PhD or anything like that, but I used to read and study a lot. And by chance, I was in Kabul when the first coup took place. The communist coup took place in April of 1978. I was in Kabul. I came back to Pakistan and I wrote a few pieces for Pakistani newspapers about what was going on. And then I was in Kabul when the Russians came in. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to London, basically, and I was with several photographers who had pictures of the Soviet invasion, but didn't have stories to go with the pictures, and they wanted to sell them to the British press. So they asked me to write a few stories, and I knew everyone in Kabul. I knew the Afghan communists. I'd met the Soviets, and purely out of curiosity and interest rather than journalism. So I started writing, and then I stayed on in London for about 3 years, actually, and I was snapped up by everyone, because at that time it was a huge story, of course, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but nobody really knew what the hell was going on. So, I bought a kind of expertise, and I knew who all the players were, and, you know, there was a lot of factionalism going on at that time. I knew which faction was trying to do what. So I started writing very extensively for the British press, the Financial Times, the Guardian, some of these Middle East magazines. Then I moved back to Pakistan in 82 and got married, and then we moved back, and I started doing full-time journalism.
Now, when one looks at your journalism, let's talk a minute about that. Is it hard for you to write? Does writing come easily to you?
Well, I think, you know, the day-to-day journalism I do, that comes pretty easily.
Yeah.
But some of the longer pieces, I mean, the essays that I do or the analysis that I do, I mean, you know, that takes more of an effort. And certainly, of course, writing books takes a great deal of effort. And it's extremely difficult in this profession because you have to, to write a book is very different from writing an 800-word story. And you've got to discipline yourself. You have to do the daily story, which is something completely different. But then at the same time, perhaps you're writing a book or writing a long essay, which requires, you know, silence and time and, thinking and reading and looking at your notes and things like that. So, I mean, it's two very different things.
And I noticed that history is a subject that you find very important as you unravel these current events. Tell us about navigating between history and research that you might do in a library versus, you know, on the spot reporting.
Yeah. Well, you know, my first book came out in 1994. It was called The Resurgence of Central Asia. And for that, it was the first book to come out after the breakup of the Soviet Union on Central Asia. And I had been traveling to Central Asia. I had no clue of you know, the history. And there was very little at that time in English on Central Asia. Mm. You had this whole Soviet school, you know, in America, all over. But nobody covered Central Asia. And I didn't speak Russian or any of the local languages. And it was really having to read, getting books from the 20s and 30s and 40s and secondhand bookshops. Mm. And, you know, so I really started reading very extensively on history then. But I think, you know, the other thing I've tried to do in all my books has been that, you know, I'm fascinated with all academic disciplines. You know, I mean, I think I read anthropology, I read history, I read economics. I mean, and I think, you know, I hope what I try to do is to kind of have a multidisciplinary approach, you know, in my books, where I'm looking at social and economic and cultural issues along with the politics and the investigative journalism side, so that it gives you a kind of a more depth, a greater richness, and you know, adds to the unfolding of these dramas, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk a little about Islam. Your new book is called Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. And one of the important points that emerges is that where Islam finds itself today is just one of several possible trajectories that in an earlier period could have led to a different path than today. Tell us a little about Islam and those possibilities for more pluralism, for a different perspective on the world and relations with the West.
Well, I think, you know, one of the tragedies of the recent era has been in the post-Soviet breakup. There was an Islamic revival, if you like, right around the world, and there were many triggers to this. There was the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan. There was, a general revival in Islamic culture and people wanting to know about religion. The Gulf War, for example, in 91 was a big trigger also. But, you know, I think where the failure has been is Muslim regimes failed to understand what was going on below the surface. Unfortunately, most Muslim regimes in the Arab world and in Asia have been very autocratic. They didn't grasp the significance of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the new world that was very swiftly emerging, the fact that there had to be a more pluralistic approach, there had to be democratization, a freer press, a freer academia, you know, to absorb all these new currents that were coming from outside, and also to absorb, if you like, the Islamic revival, which was taking on many shapes and forms. I mean, there was taking on the kind of extremist form that we saw in the early 90s with, for example, you know, the civil war in Algeria, the first Palestinian Intifada, the war in Chechnya. And there was, you know, a very genuine intellectual revival in Islam, which was extremely positive and should have been taken on board by these regimes as a part of the opening up of these political systems. But none of this really happened. So, you know, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the region that I cover, I mean, you know, Pakistan, Afghanistan, of course, was in war. The regimes in Pakistan just failed to understand the significance of the collapse of the Soviet Union and all these new currents. The Central Asian regimes, which came into being in 91, completely misunderstood and, in fact, tried to suppress all the new currents that were coming up because they still had the mentality of the Sovietized bureaucracy.
Now, a theme that emerges throughout your book is this interplay, this dynamic between external and internal forces. So let's go back a little in history. And really, the Soviet Union, in its control of Central Asia, really set in place a number of the regimes that would create, that would contribute to this set of problems. Tell us a little about that. I mean, the conduct of Soviet power in Central Asia that really isolated Islam in that part of the world from the rest of Islam on the one hand, and put in place the regimes that were not susceptible to the democratic tendencies that they should have been responsive to after the fall of the Soviet Union.
I think, you know, there were two or three crucial mistakes from the Soviet period which we are still living with in Central Asia. Mm-hmm. The first was that Stalin designated five ethnic groups as the five major nationalities of Central Asia. Central Asia has something like 100 ethnic groups, you know. And he tried to, he made nations out of these ethnic groups. So the Uzbeks, you know, were given Uzbekistan, the Kazakhs were given Kazakhstan. But, you know, Central Asia was an amalgam of tribes, clans, ethnic groups, principalities, you know. And then, you know, he created these ethnic groups and then gave them a very falsified history, which, of course, was a Soviet history, a Sovietized history. So really, it and their history had nothing to do with their own real history, you know. And parallel to this, of course, he suppressed completely Islam. I mean, religion was not allowed. And, you know, Islam was very much part of their history and tradition and culture. By suppressing Islam, he kind of cut them off from their past completely. Also, of course, you know, suppressed indigenous culture and tradition that was, you know, still inherent there. Now, I think fortunately, I mean, it's very clear now that there was a significant underground Islam that carried out throughout the 70 years of Soviet rule. But certainly when Central Asia emerges in 91 as five independent states, you know, the majority of the population knew very little about, you know, Islam and their history. The third, I think, important aspect was that the Soviets delayed for as long as possible the creation of an indigenous local elite, a local Soviet elite in Central Asia. So Central Asia, right up to the 50s, was in fact ruled by Russians, you know, white Russians, rather than the local elite. And so you get, finally in the 50s and 60s, you get this local elite, Uzbek communist elite, you know, Turkmen, Tajik, who were extremely, if you like, isolated, cut off, highly bureaucratized, and very much in debt, if you like, to Moscow for just having come up and being allowed to come up, you know. So this elite was even, in my opinion, far more backward. And of course, this elite is still ruling today because there's been no leadership change in Central Asia. This elite was far more backward than perhaps, you know, for example, the kind of movements that were taking place in the Soviet Communist Party in Russia.
Mm-hmm. You write in your new book, the genius of early Muslim Arab civilization was its multicultural, multi-religious, and multi-ethnic diversity. The stunning and numerous state failures that abound in the Muslim world today are because that original path, that intention and inspiration, has been abandoned either in favor of brute dictatorship or a narrow interpretation of theology. So that in a way, although this is a statement about a broader set of regimes, it's really a kind of perversion of what might have been.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, one of the cultural tragedies is that, you know, the fundamentalist parties today do not study history. It's not a subject in the madrasas, in the religious schools. You know, so they don't know about their own history. I mean, they don't know about the Islamic culture in Spain. I mean, the Muslims ruled Spain for 900 years alongside Jews and Christians and built the most magnificent kind of, you know, monuments which are standing today. Or the history of multicultural, multi-ethnic Muslim empires that ruled in North Africa and in the Middle East and even in South Asia, of course. If you look at the Mughals, I mean, which ruled India for 400 years, I mean, they came out of Central Asia. They brought with them a Central Asian culture, the culture of Afghanistan and Persia, you know, lived with Hindus and mixed with Hindus and Parsis and other Buddhists and other religious sects in India, ruled over them. This is the legacy, if you like, specifically of South Asia. But unfortunately, you know, the fundamentalist groups in the recent past 20 or 30 years have just failed to grasp the diversity because they don't study this.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we go back again to this, the effect, the consequences of what the external actors do, the invasion by the Soviet Union of Afghanistan is sort of a pivotal turning point in affecting the radicalization of some sectors of Islamic society in the light of this history that we just talked about. Tell us a little about the consequences of the Soviet invasion and the American response as a factor in creating this witch's brew that we now live with.
Well, the response to the Soviet invasion was, of course, then countered by the American aid to the Afghan Mujahideen with the support of Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and dozens of other countries. But essentially what the U.S., you know, launched in Afghanistan was a jihad. You know, and the Pakistani, the American, the Saudi intelligence services were all joined together in bringing into Afghanistan thousands of militants from all over the Islamic world. And, you know, at that time, the American aim was simply to show that the whole Islamic world was resisting the Soviet invasion. But essentially, they brought together these jihadi groups. And naturally, the militants who arrived to fight in Afghanistan from the Arab world, from all over, came from the most militant groups in this part of the world. Now, many of these Muslim regimes also saw this as a good way to kind of resolve their internal tensions and problems by sending these militants out, you know, and go and fight in Afghanistan. I mean, don't bother us here, you know, at home. So I think, you know, that, of course, created the roots for Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and, you know, even the Taliban, and for the subsequent upheavals that have occurred in Central Asia, even for the militants in Central Asia, because Central Asians came in the 1980s also to fight in Afghanistan and linked up with, you know, all sorts of Arab groups and Pakistani groups. So that legacy is really what we the world today is faced with.
Let's explore this a little more, because it's also regimes like the regime in Saudi Arabia and the regime in Pakistan that were actually, because of a very, in retrospect, narrow definitions of their own national interests that really fuel this fire. Let's talk, for example, about Pakistan here. It was the key agent through its intelligence services for funneling money, American money, to the Mujahideen. What was the foreign policy goal there in doing that?
Well, I mean, the foreign policy goal, I mean, first of all, was to, of course, you know, get support from the United States and the Western world, which came in a lot to Pakistan. But the other thing was that this was seen as, you know, by the military, because this was a period of military rule under General Ziaul Haq. I mean, the military saw this as an expansion of its influence inside Afghanistan for the first time. And secondly, it wanted what was termed at that time strategic depth vis-a-vis India. India being the long-term enemy of Pakistan, having a friendly Mujahideen government in Kabul would give the military the kind of what it called strategic depth, which I think was a completely fallacious argument, because Afghanistan does not give Pakistan any kind of strategic depth in real sense, because, you know, this was a devastated country. But, you know, almost immediately after the end of the Afghan war and the withdrawal of the Soviets, the war in Kashmir begins. The Kashmir insurgency starts against India. Pakistani groups first start going in and helping the Kashmiris. So almost immediately, a lot of these Mujahideen who were kind of funded and supported by the Pakistani military, you know, move from Afghanistan to Kashmir. And this, of course, creates a vast upheaval inside Pakistan, because then you have, you know, recruitment, the whole madrasa culture, the religious school culture takes off, and you have these militants training in these madrasas to fight wars. And then, of course, you know, it expands. I mean, you have Pakistanis fighting in Chechnya, in Bosnia, you know, all around the world. So, and the military fuels this simply because it believes that, you know, this is the answer. This is the answer to India. This is the way we can keep the Indians kind of down. We can keep the Indians bogged down in Kashmir. And we can, you know, the military can also extend its influence around the Muslim world.
And it's not just the Pakistanis that get implicated in this way. It's also the Saudis. Tell me a little about what the Saudis' goals were as they were confronted with this vast sea of change in Central Asia and in Afghanistan.
Well, I think, you know, the Saudis, since the time of King Faisal in the 70s, have had a very aggressive policy of exporting Wahhabism. Wahhabism is a Sunni sect, which is the state religion, if you like, of Saudi Arabia. It's a particularly austere, conservative interpretation of Islam. And it's not very popular in many areas of the world, particularly in South Asia. But the Saudis use a lot of their money and the oil money that was coming to export this, you know, through the foundations, through the royal family, as part of their foreign policy. They fund madrasas, mosques, you know, all sorts of, you know, scholarships into Saudi Arabia. And this was extremely, detrimental, because basically, you know, the Saudis were exporting Wahhabism, but they could not control the end result of what these Wahhabis were doing in Central Asia or Afghanistan or in South Asia. And many of these Saudi-funded Wahhabi groups, which the Saudis considered to be under their control, actually then become Al-Qaeda and become these extremist groups, you know. The other aspect of this was, of course, that Saudi Arabia was in competition with Iran. Iran was also aggressively exporting a revolutionary Islam, but the Shia interpretation of Islam. So the Saudis would justify their kind of Wahhabi exports, if you like, as a means to counter the influence of Shiaism in Iran.
And what you then get is a kind of a dynamic between these very narrow regimes in Central Asia who respond to this penetration by these religious fanatics from other parts of the Islamic world.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, after independence came in 1991, Central Asia was viewed by many of these groups, especially these groups who've just been fighting in Afghanistan, as kind of virgin territory. Here was a Muslim population who, according to them, knew nothing about Islam. And now we can go in with our money and our kind of influence and our particular sectarian creed, whatever it may be, Wahhabism, Deobandism, you know, and we can try and convert these people to our creed, to our sect, to our beliefs, you know. When Central Asia, essentially, is 90% Sunni Muslim, Central Asia has never been ridden with, if you like, you know, sectarian divisions within the Islamic fold. But what happens is that these groups go in, they create, you know, lobbies and support inside Central Asia. You know, these groups are from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from Saudi Arabia. And the regime reaction, of course, is to, you know, is to crack down very viciously. But the regime does not put in place a process which offers people a political alternative: democratization, economic reform, modernization. So the regime cracks down on these groups, but it also cracks down on everything else also.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously what happens is, when no political freedoms are allowed, the dissidents go underground. When you're underground, you become radicalized. And because the major influences around Central Asia were all radical Islam, the groups then, become Islamic radicals, if you like. I mean, it was very interesting. I met many in 1991, many of the secular democratic groups in Central Asia, who wanted to go like the way the Baltic republics were going, or like Russia was moving. Liberals, Democrats, wanted, human rights, freedoms, parliament, free elections, etc. Nobody lasted more than a year. I mean, they were all crushed. So the whole tendency then for the opposition in Central Asia was to become Islamicized.
In the middle of all of this, help us understand what the Taliban was and how they came to take over what had become an empty shell, I guess, of a state.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, Afghanistan had become it was a failed state. It was an empty shell. And it was relatively easy for one particular group who was, well-organized, well-funded, and had certain aims, to try and take over the country, which is, of course, what the Taliban did. But, the Taliban popularity in the beginning was based on the fact that they didn't want to seize power. There has been an evolution with the Taliban from, yes, they were very conservative and very religious-minded, in their personal practices, but they didn't have kind of ambitions to rule the country and to impose their writ on the whole country. And that made them popular in the beginning, because they were seen as bringing an end to the warlordism. And what they said was that we will hand over to our elders. We will cleanse the country of the warlords, we will disarm the population, and then we will call our elders and they will have a meeting and they will set up a government. Well, by 96, there was a group in the Taliban which was perhaps much more ideological, who then then took on the ambitions of wanting to rule Afghanistan. And then their ambition was to conquer the whole country and rule it. And then, of course, they link up with bin Laden, and there's a re-ideologizing that takes place, and the Taliban get introduced to this kind of global jihad phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
and give bin Laden all these facilities and bases and, allow him to virtually take over the running of the country, almost. So there was an evolution of the Taliban. It was a very particular phenomenon that could have gone in another direction, if certain things had not happened.
One of the tensions that you talk about in Islam is a kind of a local versus an international, a cosmopolitan versus a provincial. And you're suggesting in your new book that what you get is a global jihad without a programmatic content, without a vision of what a future Islamic state would look like. Explore that a little with us.
Well, I think the history of Islamic fundamentalism as an alternative, if you like, to British imperialism and the whole colonial era, was very rich in the 1920s and 30s, especially in the Middle East, with the creation of an Islamic state. There was a very rich debate about this, and these groups in the Middle East and then in India, British India at that time, they explored the idea of how an Islamic state would run, the Islamic economics, the treatment of minority groups, the treatment of women, education, all these major issues. Now, I think what happens, during the war in Afghanistan and events elsewhere in the Muslim world, you get a completely new generation coming up who are not rooted at all in, you know, in the history of Islam and Islamic fundamentalism in the 20th century, who are not rooted at all in the wars of liberation against colonialism, you know, which the earlier Islamic fundamentalists were rooted in. And all you get is a kind of blind hatred against against the West, against the Americans. But primarily what drives them is a hatred for their own regimes. And what they see is that because they don't have this intellectual background, they are not Islamic scholars, they are not historians, they have very little knowledge about, you know, what has gone on in the last 100 years. They have a kind of blind faith that toppling our regime, the Saudi regime, the Pakistani regime, whatever, toppling our regime and bringing in Sharia, Islamic law, will resolve all the automatically resolve all the problems of the country. Well, you know, I mean, the evidence was there already. Iran failed. I mean, you know, the Iranian revolution wanted to do just that, and it failed. You know, the Taliban wanted to do it in Afghanistan, and they failed too, you know. So they had a, you know, and they have no, there's no intellectual interest in what are they going to replace their regimes with? What are they going to offer the people? And I think that's why they remain, if you like, on the extreme terrorist fringe of society. They never develop into mass parties. You know, their action is militant, is to topple. It's not to build or create.
Let's take three leaders who you talk about from this Islamic fundamentalist side, and I'm talking here about Juma Namagani, Osama bin Laden, and Mullah Muhammad Omar. Are there similarities between them? If so, what are they? What are the differences? How do they fit into the picture that we've been talking about?
Well, I think, you know, they fit in very seriously into this idea of global jihad, this kind of the idea that you can destroy but you don't have to build, and you don't have to offer an alternative to people about, you know, society and justice and state building. All three, for example, are extremely secretive. They are not interviewed, they are not photographed, there is no tradition of any kind of intellectual tradition amongst them. You know, they don't have party manifestos. They don't offer the alternative as to what, you know, what will they hope to achieve once the regimes are toppled. And essentially, you know, it's the secrecy around these movements and the extreme difficulty of getting access to the leadership of these movements, you know, really makes them, if you like, very negative forces, you know, even within the Islamic tradition. Because Islam is not about secrecy and evasion and avoiding being interviewed or avoiding giving lectures. I mean, the whole history of Islamic scholarship and Islamic empire building, you know, right from the Middle Ages, is about debate and discussion. And, you know, the hallmark of the madrasa culture is debate and discussion, and then arriving at a consensus. I mean, one of them, you know, ijtihad, which is that, you know, the madrasas are supposed to teach the students all the various interpretations of Islam. And then it is the job of the teacher to kind of build a consensus within the classroom about, you know, where do you think now we should kind of be heading, and what should be the, you know, what should be our interpretation of Islam in this era for these times. You know, but all that is missing from these three men, and in that sense, they're identical.
And in this context, the word jihad takes on an entirely different meaning. Is that correct?
Yes. Jihad is one tenet of Islam. It's a very important tenet, but it's one of the five major tenets of Islam. And what the global jihadists do, or what these three figures do, is to elevate jihad as to be the only tenet of Islam. And the most important tenet of Islam. Well, you know, prayer, charity, you know, performing the Hajj. I mean, there are all sorts of other things that Muslims, you know, have to do. And the first issue is that. The second issue is that, you know, in the Quran it says very clearly that, you know, there are two sides to jihad. There is certainly a side where Muslims have to defend themselves if they're attacked by unbelievers, which is, if you like, the militant side of Islam. But that is what, you know, the Prophet Muhammad called the lesser jihad. The greater jihad is the improvement of self and the improvement of community. As in all great religions, you know, Islam has an enormous kind of legacy of how do you become a better human being, how do you become an asset to society, how do you help other people, you know. I mean, it's just like the Christian tradition, the Buddhist tradition, the Jewish tradition, you know, of religion, that, you know, religion is supposed to be about building community and building civil society and improving yourself in the process while you worship God. You know, and you know, the greater jihad is all about that. But of course, that is totally ignored by these figures.
This perversion of jihad, are there any similarities with the International Communist Party in terms of, you know, the organization format, in terms of its emphasis on secrecy and cells and so on?
Well, I think, you know, certainly in the 20s and 30s, I think the Islamic fundamentalist movements took a lot, not from the ideology, but from the organizational capabilities and abilities of the communists, you know, in Russia and Eastern Europe and even in the Muslim world. If you read all the scholars of, for example, the Ikhwan movement in Egypt in the 20s and 30s, the Jamaat-e-Islami in and Sayyid al-Maududi, who headed the Jamaat-e-Islami in India, British India, in the 40s, you know, they had all read Lenin. They were great, you know, they were admirers of Lenin in the sense that, you know, and they'd all read, for example, his very famous tract, What Is to Be Done, where, you know, in 1903, I think, he sets out the kind of how the communist system is supposed to be organized in cells and how it can propagate and all the rest of it. So, you know, I mean, there was certainly an influence in that element, yes.
Let's talk a little about U.S. foreign policy as it relates to all of these issues. Reading your book, I made the following notation: from covert policy to no policy to today to military policy. Yeah. That's my shorthand. Comment on that and also try to help us understand what has been our failure in the region, if any.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, I think, you know, there has been overall a kind of trend towards isolation. The two Clinton administrations intervened in the world only under extreme pressure, either domestic pressure or international pressure. There was really no kind of understanding of what was going on or particular interest of what was going on in the outside world. And, of course, even less of an interest in the Muslim world. And I think, you know, the U.S. just completely missed out on this whole kind of Islamic revival business, you know, and trying to get these Muslim regimes through aid, through pressure, through other, you know, to get them to do the right thing. And of course, you know, the chickens have come home to roost, as they say. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, right now, I think, you know, what we're seeing now, for example, in Afghanistan is, I think, you know, and even in Central Asia, I think the U.S., since September the 11th, has been driven too heavily, if you like, by the defense planners, you know, by the Pentagon, by the, you know, by the military. Now, clearly, there was a time for that and a period for that in during the war in Afghanistan, when, you know, the military had to be in the driving seat. But what you need in this region now is really a very multidimensional policy of state building, of nation building, and other arms of the government have to come into this. The State Department, the Agency for International Development, you know, the Information Services, the Treasury even, you know. I mean, but what we are not seeing in this kind of post-war scenario, and I do believe now that the war in Afghanistan is over. Yes, there's a mopping up operation in a very small area of Afghanistan. But, you know, this mopping up operation does not affect 95% of the population in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, even though we are seeing, you know, these mopping up operations carry on CNN and on the big screen because American troops are on the ground for the first time. But essentially, you have to bring this into perspective, that this is a mopping up operation in 10 or 20 or 50 square miles of territory. You know, what is needed now are, you know, other elements of U.S. government to come into the driving seat, to support the interim government for reconstruction of Afghanistan, to try and ease the political tensions inside the country. And of course, the same is needed in Central Asia, where the Americans now have bases. Again, it's a military-driven policy. What is needed here is, I think, much greater pressure combined with incentives, a policy of carrot and stick with the Central Asian regimes, that look, we'll help you militarily deal with the threats you face, but you have to do carry out certain reform agendas, you know, and our aid will be kind of limited to or subjugated to certain conditionalities. That we, you know, we want a timetable from you. Please carry out certain reforms, you know. So I think, again, what is needed is a much broader, multidimensional strategy by all the arms of the U.S. government in order to achieve, if you like, primarily what it should be the aim, which is to not only eliminate terrorism, but also stabilize this region.
Now, one of the problems with American foreign policy is our unilateralist bent. And it would seem in this part of the world where so many external actors have an interest and see this area as a means to the ends of those interests, there really has to be some sort of understanding that many interests are engaged and that they have to be brought in. What is the best strategy for doing that?
Well, you know, one of the greatest tragedies of Afghanistan, and of course why the civil war has continued for so long, is because of outside interference of all the neighboring countries, you know.
Which goes back in history.
Yeah, of course, because Afghanistan is landlocked. It has always been a very fragile state. The Afghans have always had to balance off Russia, you know, India, Pakistan, Iran, the Gulf states. And of course, you know, the intervention of these neighbors has been hugely detrimental to Afghanistan. You know, it's absolutely vital at this stage that the U.S., you know, first of all, you know, which it has, I mean, publicly taken a position against any kind of neighborhood intervention inside Afghanistan, but also then works with the neighbors. Now, all the neighbors have interests. You can't pretend that these interests don't exist, and you can't kind of just crush them and push them down. Otherwise, they will reemerge, you know, once the U.S. gets out of the region. So I think, you know, the U.S. has to work with the neighbors, and then it has to work with a broader, you know, with the coalition against terrorism, which of course includes, you know, the whole world, basically, mm-hmm. But particularly the Europeans. And I think, you know, I can understand the U.S. desire to carry out the military campaign in a unilateral way so as not to be interfered with, if you like, by other armies and other chains of command or, you know, the United Nations or whatever. But when it comes to, in the post-war scenario, when it comes to reconstruction and development and ensuring stability and security, that the political process in Afghanistan can begin and a genuine, recognized government can emerge, it's absolutely essential that the U.S. works with all the coalition partners.
What about your native country, Pakistan? Can it change itself, given the road it's gone during this period of your reporting, which seems to have gone down to a road which led to a dead end, basically?
Well, you know, Pakistan has, I think, come a long way since September the 11th, but it has not come far enough, I think. You know, the fact is that there is a military regime in Pakistan. They did a U-turn after September the 11th. They were supporting the Taliban. They then dumped the Taliban, you know. But there was a certain logic, I think, that followed that. Yes, you dumped the Taliban under this huge American pressure, you know. And the military really had no choice in the matter. But once it had taken that decision, it was going to be, you know, any Pakistani saw that the military now had to also curb domestic extremism inside Pakistan. And the third part of that logic was that you had to deal with Kashmir and India and the end of support for extremism, you know, outside your borders in Kashmir. Now, the problem has been in Pakistan that I don't think the military have carried out stage two and stage three. Of this, and they have to some extent carried out stage two, but they're doing it, you know, the curbing domestic extremism. They're doing it reluctantly. They're doing it half-heartedly because I don't think there has been a strategic decision yet on what to do with India. Is Pakistan going to go genuinely for a settlement of Kashmir and a settlement with problems with India? And is India going to do the same, you know, or not? So in that sense, you know, the military perhaps has some idea of trying to keep some of these extremist groups in reserve, you know, because they were always, if you like, the front line against India, you know. And to curb all the extremists immediately and without any conditions, would, as far as the military thinking is concerned and the military mindset is concerned, perhaps expose Pakistan and the military, you know, to repercussions from India.
Is the killing of the Wall Street Journal reporter and the handling of that after the arrests an important in pointing which direction Pakistan will go, or is it just a kind of a minor case?
No, I think it was a very important watershed case because, I mean, the fact is that Danny Pearl, you know, was killed by groups, you know, who have very close links with the military and the intelligence services over a long number of years. You know, now I think, you know, this should galvanize the military to realize now that these groups who have been in their service for many years, fighting in Afghanistan, fighting in Kashmir, fighting in many places, are now a threat to Pakistan itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and here you know here you get this contradiction because there's always a problem with military regimes. You know, are these military regimes carrying out policies and decisions in their own interests, in the interests of the army, or in the interests of the nation? And basically, what I think Pakistanis are expecting and hoping President Musharraf to do is to think of the nation first, and not to think of just, you know, purely in that kind of military mindset, with that tunnel vision that the military, you know, leaders tend to have.
You call Pakistan a failed state, and what would be a measure of it moving beyond that state?
No, I don't call Pakistan a failed state. I call it a potentially failing state.
Failing state. Okay.
A failing state. Okay. I think Afghanistan was a failed state.
Yeah, okay.
You know, but you know, I think the most essential part now is, as Musharraf, you know, he has to have elections by October. I think the most important part is how is the military going to share power with civil society. You know, we've had periods of democratically elected governments which have also failed. All the military regimes have also failed. You know, is the military now realizing for the first time that you cannot set up a kind of either a puppet government through a rigged election, which I fear Musharraf may be trying to do, which would be a disaster, I think, because this, you know, the repercussions of this would come 6 months down the road, you know. Nor can you possibly allow a complete kind of revulsion to kind of free, you know, allow sort of some of these corrupt politicians to come back. So I think what many people are envisaging is a sharing of power for a certain period of time, perhaps, while this crisis persists, between the military and the and civil society and the politicians. Will the military actually carry out a genuine sharing of power and not a fake sharing of power whereby it retains all power for itself but has a civilian puppet? You know, and I think that's, you know, the primary issue. Because, you know, the problems in Pakistan are immense. You know, the educational system has collapsed, you've got extremism, you've got a huge economic recession, you have ethnic divisions, you have a foreign policy that has been a total disaster for the last 10 years, you know, and you have to rectify all these things. But it cannot be done by military fiat. It cannot be done by command and order. You know, it has to be done by involving people in decision making through some kind of representation. And I think, you know, the military has to go in for a free and fair election which will set up a civilian government. And I think, you know, by and large, most Pakistanis accept that there will have to be limits on that civilian government and there will have to be a sharing of power with the military.
After reading your two books, I'm left with the sense that one way to look at the events of 9/11 is that it was a fire bell in the night, that it woke us up to forces and issues that are clearly presented in your books, but were not in our public consciousness or in the consciousness of our leaders enough. Comment on that. Do you think that might be one positive outcome?
Well, you know, I certainly wrote the Taliban book as a warning that if you ignore Afghanistan, there's going to be enormous instability in the region. Now, you know, obviously I didn't predict 9/11, but, you know, I wrote this book a year before 9/11, and I gave many seminars and talked frequently in Washington and New York about this. And, I think there was an awareness, but amongst people in government during the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, but there was an unwillingness. I think the will was not there to change policy and to change track and to do something about Afghanistan. The Central Asia book, I think, is also a warning. I mean, this was also written before 9/11. And what I'm basically trying to say here is that, you know, the next explosion, a social and economic explosion, will occur in Central Asia in the months and years ahead, unless something is done, you know, quickly. And the danger in Central Asia is the same. The only political forces which could take advantage and could take a leadership role in such an explosion would be the extremist groups. And that would be detrimental not just to Central Asia, but to everyone else also. I hope these two books do serve as some kind of warning that, you know, the world cannot allow, and I think the biggest message from 9/11 is that the world cannot allow states to fail. You know, you cannot allow having these kind of failed states around the world where terrorism and drugs and, you know, weapons and extremism breed. You know, and that has to mean, surely, a much greater U.S. involvement with the world around it.
If students were to watch this fascinating story, both the story of Central Asia and your involvement in it, what advice, other than reading your two books, would you give them in terms of preparing for the future?
Well, you know, one of my real kind of pleas, especially for my colleagues in the media in America, is that, you know, I think there has been a horrible dumbing down of America in the last decade on foreign policy issues. You know, the ignorance in the United States is huge, you know, and I think the media and the government certainly perhaps, but certainly the media is very much at fault here. You know, and I think there has to be a much greater awareness of foreign policy issues. Your governments, U.S. governments have got away with either doing nothing or doing the wrong thing or getting involved under various pressures because there has been no real domestic debate about foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Foreign policy issues are not on anybody's agenda. You know, and I think it's very important for young people to get involved with foreign policy issues and to understand the world around them.
And for these students, what would be your thoughts about the lesson that they might learn from your story, your personal story, of somebody who sort of landed on his feet with a story that many people were unaware of, but really became of global importance? Any lessons for students?
No, I think, you know, in today's age, I mean, I'm an old man now. I mean, but, you know, I
please,
but,
that old man.
But, you know, but I think in today's age, I mean, what I admire so much about so many students and who I talk to at universities and all is, you know, this kind of multidisciplinary approach. You know, I mean, yes, you have to focus on your degree and your subject and your discipline, but you've got to be interested in other things also. You know, we're here in the heart of Silicon Valley, and, you know, I hear, you know, I mean, these computer experts, you know, they don't read newspapers, they don't follow foreign affairs, you know. I mean, that's not the kind of world that we have to grow up in now, I think. You know, I mean, I would love students who come out of American universities to be interested in everything, curious about everything, you know. Now, that doesn't, you know, it can mean travel, it can mean reading the newspaper, it can mean, you know, watching different TV programs, whatever. But I think, you know, there has to be a curiosity about what's going on in the outside world. And I think, you know, going back to my mother, I mean, you know, and what I'm still immensely curious. I mean, you know, I never met Osama bin Laden. I never met Jomana Mangani either. But, you know, I'm very curious about, you know, what makes these guys tick? You know, why is it they do what they do? You know, and to understand that, you have to, it's not just understanding the individual or the personality, it's understanding history and culture and tradition and all sorts of geography and anthropology and all sorts of things. And I would love to see that kind of curiosity among students.
Ahmed, on that note, I want to thank you very much for exploring your reflections on this region that you've covered for the last 20 years and your thoughts about your own involvement in that region. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.